When I left that at age 24, I was looking for freedom, dove headfirst into, you know, hedonism and experiencing as many different things as possible. And like I said, in 2022, I realized I was only swapping one set of chains for another.
Candid conversations that might just change how you look at the world. Let's bridge cultures, transcend borders, and build a global family of changemakers. Welcome to If By Chance.
Our 20s are a time of finding out who we are, setting goals, and getting a head start on our careers. Brandon Steenhook is a 20-something working in Hollywood who realized that although he was kicking goals professionally, his lifestyle wasn't as fabulous as he first thought.
I've been in film for several years, and last year I just started working on my first animated feature film, and it's fully computer animated. So I'm going from like the VFX world, which is a live action movie that inputs computer animation in it, most of the time hiding it to make it seem like this is part of what the camera captured. But then there are other times where there's a dragon. We all know that there's not really a dragon. We're creating a beautiful computer animated dragon. And so I'm going from that world into all animated. There's now nothing that's live action on this movie. It's all created from the computer. And it has been fascinating to learn about how we create these textures and how we create these characters and environments. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
So what made you get into the industry?
Great question. I think ever since I was a little kid, I knew that I wanted to be in entertainment because I decided that the most important thing in life is to make other people happy. And I wanted to first do that by making music, and I loved making music, but there seemed to be this feeling of like, you can't really make a career in music. That's a very big construct that kind of like shaped my life. It was like, you can do music for fun, but it's not a career. And so I started going to college, and I discovered that film had a lot more people that were doing it, I guess. And it was still artistic and it was secure and it felt like a really good fit. So I started trying it, and I very quickly fell in love with being on set and creating stories and emotions in people that watch the stories. And yeah, been doing it ever since.
Was it really hard to break into?
It's kind of interesting because I was living in Utah at the time, going to college, and I don't even remember how I figured this out, but there was a Facebook page or group that people would post if they needed a hand on a film set. It was called like Utah Filmmakers or something like that. So somehow I discovered this and I started responding to everything like, I want to try that. I want to do that. And eventually I got a gig. I was running coffee for like a small little shoot, and I talked to the producer, and we kind of became friends, and he was like, you know, you're doing a good job, so I want to get you on the next one. And from there, like, I started meeting more people on the next one and the next one. And once I got my first opportunity, I just wanted to prove myself over and over and over again. And I think people responded to that like I was willing to do whatever it took.
How much was that first experience about coffee? And when did people actually allow you to start using your skills?
Yeah, so the first experience I think was almost like, can we trust this person to do very menial tasks? Because if you can trust somebody to do very menial tasks, then you can trust them to do something a little more important. And the level of importance and responsibility grows every time that you prove yourself. And that was kind of my experience. So after, I think, two or three more of those smaller type things, I was also studying at college, like how to edit. So As I was talking to the producer about that, he said, okay, this would be really useful. You can like start editing the dailies as we're shooting on this next commercial. And, you know, that was a much bigger responsibility. But because I showed that I was trustworthy in the small tasks that I was doing, I could, you know, keep proving myself in that way. And eventually, I think after 4 or 5 months of working with this guy and a lot of other people, he called me and said, hey, there's a guy that I work with who's looking for a challenge producer on this reality show. I think you'd be a great fit. So tell me if you're interested and we'll connect you. And that ended up being my first full-time job leaving college. It was really cool.
So from what you're describing, it sounds like it's not the same sort of experience a lot of people have when they go and they get an education. It's still very much a world of apprenticeship.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. In fact, even the producer that I worked with, he said he never finished college, and he said, don't let a formal education block you from learning what you need to learn. And he wasn't saying quit college, but he was saying like, figure out what is most important to you. And so for me, it was, I wanted to experience holding the props and moving the lights where they needed to go and how to use a camera. And I found for me personally, I learn much quicker and more clearly when I'm touching things. And it's harder for me to learn if I'm reading or listening to somebody talk to me about how to do something. Like, I need to be touching it. So that was a really great education for me, moving lights around and being in almost every single department in film before I started producing for that reality show, and from there went into the VFX world.
What's been the best advice that has got you to where you are today?
Oh, wow. Okay, I'm just going to tell you and maybe show you. Ever since, I want to say 2015, I have been collecting quotes from both people that I know and people that I read in books and articles. And this just goes on forever.
So that's a note?
This
a
is
note on your
phone
with quotes?
Yeah, a note on my phone of quotes that I turn to. And for many different specific situations, like that was the one about learning. There's a really great, I think it's Kubrick quote, where he says, treat people or teach people the way you want to be treated. Meaning like the way that you show up is the way that you're teaching people how to treat you. And I think when I was younger, I didn't really understand that. So I was nervous and shy, and I didn't realize that I was actually teaching people, this is the way I want to be treated. Because I didn't want to be treated that way. So when I read that, it made me realize I could be the version of myself that I wanted to be in film. I guess it stayed in that specific place. And that was what kind of enabled me to be so friendly and charismatic, I guess, on set, making friends and putting myself out there, I guess, and not being afraid.
So do you find that you're a slightly different person outside of work?
So I would say that was kind of how it started. And then I realized that I just liked that version of myself. And I think that that was always who I was, but there was like this level of fear that kind of kept me down, or anxiety or judgment, self-judgment. There's a lot of that in my life. So the more that I step away from that self-judgment, the more I'm able to just fully express myself. And actually, I go into that a lot in the book that I wrote, which I didn't actually expect that would be one of the results of the 100 days of quitting everything. I didn't expect that that would be a result at all. I thought I was just going to discover better, higher levels of energy and dopamine and focus and clarity. But I also discovered that I was secretly, I didn't even fully realize it, but I was constantly facing my own self-judgment and hiding from it with those things that I was distracting myself from.
So can you tell me more about the 100 days of quitting?
Yes. So it started out with, I think it was December of 2022. I'm living a pretty interesting career, and I think it's very exciting. It's fun. It's also a lot of work. And I was waking up probably around 5:30 every morning to work out so that I had to have enough time to work. And then after work, I would go either to like a film screening or some sort of industry event, or I'd go hang out with my friends, maybe go to a party. And I'd usually be getting home by 12 or 1 a.m. and then start the whole thing over again. And I kind of felt like a walking zombie. And I was wondering, like, could this really be what I've been working for all this time? Like, is this what I've been searching for? Is this happiness? And I realized, no, I don't think it is. And so I started talking to some of my friends about it. And I realized that while there are aspects of this life that were really great, there was some things that I needed to change, a reset, if you will. And in film, when a director watches a shot and he decides there was something in it that he didn't like, he says, or the AD, the assistant director, yells, back to one. And everybody sets everything back to the way it was at the very beginning of the shot, and then we can roll another take. So I decided it's time for me to go back to one. Let's go back to where I lost focus. What's happening? Why do I feel this way? And what can I do to change it? And I decided that those things were, first of all, things that I needed to cut, that were distracting me, that were blocking me from having my full levels of clarity and energy and focus. And I decided those were caffeine, sugar, social media, porn, dating apps, weed, and other like psychedelic drugs, and refined grains was the last one. And those were the things that I pinpointed as like, these are things that are almost driving my life right now, outside of work. And my motivation for doing things almost always tended to go to one of those aspects of my life. And I didn't want that to be the case anymore. And so I decided I needed to replace those with healthy behaviors. And those were getting at least 7 hours of sleep a night, working out or moving my body. That could also just be like yoga for at least an hour a day. And the third was having at least one or two like clean, healthy, organic, like fresh meals, basically, that I would be preparing myself. And so that was the structure that I created for my 100 days. And I believed that if I could follow this, my kind of dopamine roller coaster life of like, I'm either high or I'm low, could be more level, and my baseline could be higher. So I wouldn't have to hit highs as often as I could.
Had you been watching Andrew Huberman?
A little bit. Yeah, I love Huberman. He says so many interesting things.
And did you do all of these things at once?
Yes.
Tell me about the first week.
Yeah, the first week was brutal, I think is the best word for it. I still felt like a zombie because I still hadn't really been getting sleep. So that plus the fact that I couldn't reach out to my things that I was used to having. The first day that I deleted social media from my phone, I unconsciously grabbed my phone and swiped to where Instagram was and tried to click it 17 times in an hour and then it wasn't until my finger was hovering over the thing that doesn't exist anymore that was when I realized like what I had just done over and over again, 17 times. So yeah, I think there was a discovering like, wow, I was even less in control than I thought I was. social media was controlling me before I even realized it. I kind of felt like a puppet.
How long have you been a social media user?
I think it was 2010 when I got a Facebook. That was the first one. That would have been, oh man, you're making me do math right now. I'm going to guess 16. I don't know if that's entirely accurate. It might have been 15, but we'll say 16.
It's a while, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Well, and I had done 30-day social media fasts in the past, I think 2 or 3. But I noticed that after 30 days of quitting, within 2 weeks, I would be right back at the same level that I was before. And so I wanted to try something that wasn't just going to be difficult. I wanted it to actually change not only my habits, but my desires. So that was why I decided to go with 100.
And what did you notice after the second week?
Second week, it went from pain to, well, no, actually, second week was still painful, but the third week became numbing. Like, it went from I was in pain to I can't really feel very much. did you ever see Fight Club?
No. So tell me about it.
Okay, sure. I also recommend it. It's a great movie and book. So there's a guy who is living in the corporate world. He goes to the office and he has meetings, but in nighttime, he is also having these big fight clubs and he's getting in fights on, like, people are gathering at a place just to punch each other, and it's to make them feel more alive. So when he gets back to the office the next day, he's got a black eye and he feels like everything around him is blurrier because it's not as intense as it was when he was getting punched and punching. You know, like his visceral senses are muted. And that was how I was feeling. Tasting wasn't as strong as it used to be. Things that would give me pleasure, like listening to music that gave me pleasure, usually was just like blah. And that was new for me.
So I guess, like, in terms of your dopamine levels, you were artificially heightening them for quite some time. So to remove all of that stimuli, and for your body to reset itself, it was going to take some time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how long did it take?
I think the numbness went away around day 30. And that was kind of coming back to normal-ish levels again. What I didn't expect is, I think it was day 54, I felt like I was in a state of ecstatic bliss for almost 2 weeks straight after going, 52, 54 days without anything. That was very surprising.
What were the remaining days like? What were your key takeaways?
I think it was day 70. I went to Roatan for a scuba diving trip. It's an island off the coast of Honduras. And I was faced with the vacation style, like, life, you know, very different from regular life. And in my past, when I'm on vacation, I throw away all of my daily routines and I say, I'm on vacation, I can do whatever I want, you know? And so I realized that I was facing this opportunity to rewire that, to reframe that. So I got to the first restaurant and it was like on the beach, and I was thinking it would be so wonderful to have a beautiful glass of wine, you know, like that's what I would usually do. But I decided that instead of continuing to say, like, to have a connection that beautiful island locations and alcohol are tied together, I wanted to stay on my routines throughout the entire vacation. And that's what I decided to do almost the entire time. On my way home, I got stuck in Miami for 2 days unexpectedly, and I ran into a friend and he was taking us around, and he took us to like the bar area of Miami, and I was like, I'm not really drinking right now, but we ended up walking to this mojito place. That's kind of my weak spot. I love rum, I love mojitos. So I was like, oh no, I'm on vacation, but also this isn't, I'm not even supposed to be here. Maybe this is like a good day to have a cheat day. So I talked myself into buying a mojito, and within the very first sip, I could feel my awareness level drop. I was, before having this sip, I was at a level of awareness that, and it, this is hard to explain, but like the music that I was hearing in that room or in that bar was like at a certain height, a certain level. The feeling of the air on my skin, it's very humid there, and I could like feel the condensation on my skin and the heat. And as soon as that very first sip hit my tongue, and this may be placebo, I don't know, but my experience was that this level of awareness dropped. I wasn't no longer aware of how my skin was feeling. This music almost seemed to go down a little bit. And when I had that realization, like as soon as I put the cup back down after that sip, I was like, whoa, this is what I've been doing to myself for years. And I had no idea because I was used to it. 74 days was the longest I had ever gone without drinking since the very first time that I'd take a drink. And I had never stopped and asked myself, what am I giving up in return for this momentary sensation? And so this was the very first time that I was able to do that.
Did it continue until day 100?
Yes. The very next day, I did not drink anymore after that. And in the book, I kind of go a little bit more in depth of like the rest of that experience. But this was a very good lesson for me of why I was doing it. And sometimes I've noticed that the best lessons, the lessons that are the most impactful for me are when I do something that I shouldn't have done. Unfortunately, when I make a mistake, I tend to learn more from that than if I'm doing things right over and over again. So it was that very impactful moment that reaffirmed what I was doing. I was like, I'm so glad that I'm doing this 100 days. It's so key to feeling freedom, finding freedom from anything that feels like it's controlling me. And that makes sense because growing up, I was in the Mormon church. It was a very strict doctrine that I was brought up in. And when I left that at age 24, I was looking for freedom, dove headfirst into, you know, hedonism and experiencing as many different things as possible. And like I said, in 2022, I realized I was only swapping one set of chains for another. I was not actually any more free than I was before. So this 100 days, in a sense, was a play for me, almost like my final play of like what, I guess final play is not the right word, but it was the next idea that I had. How can I gain this freedom if these last two things didn't work? And feels like it worked.
So you spoke about going from a life of being within the Mormon church, Mormon religion, to a hedonistic lifestyle, and then replacing that with the 100 days.
Okay.
All of those ideas seem somewhat consuming. And now that you have a different perspective, I'm wondering if doing the 100 days has created space for you to be able to step back and carve out time for different things so that you're not having to put yourself in such a regimented and full framework.
Yeah, no, that's such a good question. And I think that's kind of exactly what It did, because as we both know, 100 days of quitting everything is extreme. It's very extreme, and it's, in a sense, all-consuming. But as soon as I finished the 100 days, I realized that I had very little desire to do any of those things still. So I was able to rewire the desires, and because I no longer desired to do them, they weren't consuming those places in my brain of like, okay, do this now. So I gained more time to do the things that I care about, spending time with my cat, reading books. And then I started writing this book, because every single day during the 100 days, I wrote a journal entry. And at the end of the 100 days, I realized that I had done something that completely changed my life. And I wondered if there was anybody else like me who felt controlled by these dopamine substances and behaviors that and wanted to find freedom from. And then I started talking to friends about it, and they were like, I'm struggling with X and Y, and I'm struggling with Z. You know, like, I think in this society, especially with social media, with sugar, with alcohol, marketing is, and the amount of access that we have to these things is so much higher than what our evolution ever expected or prepared us for. We have a desire to eat sugar. And so every single processed food company has pushed that to the extreme. And, you know, same with alcohol. We have a desire to feel sexy and feel powerful. And alcohol companies have construed that to be the reason why we drink, you know. And same with social media. This, we want to stay connected to people. We're a social species. But in our past, you know, we were living in small tribes. And the amount of people that we have access to now is far exceeding the amount of space we have in our brain to think about each of them. So I think that by simplifying those and kind of removing them, I was able to focus on what I can do. What I can do to, I guess, because we were talking earlier about what a career, like what drives you to do a career. And I can't remember who said this, but I really love it. The best career that you can have is the one where you utilize your skills, your special skills and talents to help the most people possible. And I realized, like, by doing this, if there's anybody else like me who's going through this experience and wonders if anybody else is going through this experience of like feeling like they don't have control, then I'm able to say, look, you're not alone.
Have you read BJ Fogg's book, Tiny Habits?
No, it's called Tiny Habits.
Yeah, so he was also involved with helping people, possibly inadvertently, create social media apps.
Oh, okay.
So listening to you, I obviously don't know you, but I'm wondering about your personality type. So BJ Fogg's premise is that the best way to establish habits is to start tiny and to really look at triggers and anchors, and I can't remember the whole framework. So when you were talking before about you trying to open Instagram 17 times in an hour, he's worked with these app designers to see, you know, what are the things going on in these people's lives that they will reach for the app and use it as a crutch.
Yeah.
And so you sound like someone who really likes to immerse themselves in the experience of whatever it is that you're doing. Mm-hmm. You like to get to know everything that is involved in the creation of something. Is that why you redesigned your life, basically, as opposed to taking a tiny habits approach? And do you think that's more appropriate for someone like you, the redesigning of the whole of your day?
It must be a personality type thing, because for me, like I said, I had tried just quitting social media for 30 days and it wasn't good enough. So I think that for me, I did need a full reset. That's so interesting. I had never thought about that. So that there seems to be a certain personality type that requires like a stronger flip as opposed to the smaller.
That's what I'm wondering. So in this book, Tiny Habits, it's very much about, you know, when I put my feet on the floor, mm-hmm. I might drop down and do a few push-ups. So it becomes such a habit that when you do that thing, let's just say you pour yourself a cup of coffee and you give the bench a wipe if you have trouble keeping your kitchen clean, for example. But it's very much about weaving those triggers and anchors into your life so that you make the changes that you want to see. And that's what he's helped app designers do, and that so that you creating a habit, because at certain points in your day, you just automatically reach for your phone. The same way that we might reach for a drink, you know, at the end of a day to celebrate, to commiserate, all those types of things.
Absolutely.
So how would you describe your personality?
I was diagnosed with ADHD in high school and given a bunch of Ritalin. And after, I think, 2 weeks, I could not do Ritalin anymore because I would get into class and immediately start working on homework. And my friends would like be talking to me and I'd be like, I'm so focused that I don't want to talk to anybody. I wasn't able to eat anything. I'd get home and look for more homework to do. I felt like a robot, basically. It probably gave me too much Ritalin, but it really turned me off to the experience. So that is probably part of it, is the ADHD.
Stephen Bartlett, Diary of a CEO, he's recently determined that he's got ADHD, and he completely fills his schedule and has structures and, you know, has to achieve certain goals every day. And I wonder if it's just about recognizing the sort of person that we are. You know, some of us, you know, we're not going to sit down and necessarily do meditation, and that's just not who we are. And we're better off just playing to our strengths and, I guess, putting structures in place for us to thrive, as opposed to pretending that we're someone that we're not.
Man, that's beautiful. I like that, because I kind of believe that if somebody doesn't feel the need to meditate and they're kind of like, I'm doing great without it, then like, more power to you. You don't need, you know, nobody needs to do anything really other than like eat and sleep and, you know. I think it kind of reminds me, have you heard of the Enneagram personality test?
No.
You know about that? That's kind of what you were talking about reminds me of. There's a little test that you take on the internet, and then it tells you you're one of 9 different Enneagrams, and I believe that the Enneagram is your motivation. And mine, when I did it, the first one was like achievement and accomplishment. That's what motivates me the most. So perhaps somebody with my personality type in that way, my motivation style, would have that. And then somebody who's looking for, like, for example, another one could be you desire to feel secure or safe. That might not be the same type of personality that you would want to like completely change your life. You know, that doesn't feel very safe.
Do you think you're an extrovert or an introvert?
For me, I'm a little bit of both. I need me time in order to feel okay out in public. But if I've gotten enough me time, then I'm very extroverted. So I'd say that's kind of like, I used to have to have a drink or smoke some weed when I was out in a party beforehand because I wanted to feel relaxed. And the reason I needed to feel relaxed is because I wasn't giving myself any me time to actually think about things or write. Writing in my journal has become the main way that I disseminate all of my thoughts, and I feel out of my head when I'm in public. But if I don't get that time, then I'm not an extrovert. I feel very disconnected from people.
And in terms of writing the book, how was that for you?
Great question. Yeah. So right after I finished the 100 days, and it probably took a week or two off of writing, other than because I was writing every day in my journal. And then when I got back to it, I was like, I really like this practice. I'm going to start writing for an hour a day, and I'm going to turn this finding, all of these findings, all of this, these stories into a book that's as digestible as possible and as easy for somebody to follow as possible. And I want to say it took about 6 months to finish the first draft, 100 pages. And then I did another 3 months of rewrites and revisions. And I just actually got a draft back from a very close friend of mine who read the whole thing and gave me very useful notes about structuring the different places. So it's not, again, my ADD brain thinks that certain things fit in a certain sequential order. And he's like, this doesn't make any sense. You should put this here and this here, you know? So it's great to have good friends that don't have the same mental situation as me.
And who would you say doing the 100 days best suits? Who is this book for?
I think this book is for people who have been having fun. It started out having fun going to festivals and partying, and they've reached a point that they don't feel like it's fun anymore. It feels necessary. It feels obligatory. It feels like the only way to survive. If that's you, then I think this book is exactly what you need to get you out of that and take back control of your life. And if you feel the same way about social media, if you feel like you're on TikTok for 3 hours a day, this would be another great tool for you to see the reasons why it's happening and how you can pull yourself out of it. If you don't want to change anything about your life, this book is not for you.
Has anyone else around you changed because of this?
Yes. So I started talking about the idea of 100 days about a month before I began, and five other people ended up doing the entire thing with me. They had slightly different versions. One person ate raw food for 100 days. One person, what did he do? It was some dietary thing also, something about oils. There's only specific oils that he wanted to use. And so by talking about this idea of like, you can choose your desires or what you know is healthy for you, and then having the accountability of this group of people whenever I wanted to slip, whenever I wanted to, I can't tell you how many days that I was eating regular dinner and thinking about how badly I wanted to eat ice cream afterwards. And that was actually the only thing I wanted to eat. I didn't want to eat spaghetti. I just wanted the ice cream afterwards. And I would text my friends and be like, hey, I really want to eat ice cream right now. And just telling somebody that I wanted to break made it so much easier to not.
So is there any thought to creating some sort of social element to this that isn't on social media?
I do think that a lot of my audience would be on social media. I actually started a vlog on TikTok leading up to my 100 days. And I said, while I'm not going to be on TikTok other than uploading this video every day, I think that this is a good way to reach out to people, like I said, who might be as addicted to social media as I am, just doom scrolling. If you see somebody who's quitting everything on your doom scroll, maybe that would be inspiring. I hope that it would.
Is there anything that you would like to talk about that we haven't so far?
On top of the self-judgment, this may be just a piece of self-judgment, but I discovered that a huge reason why I kept leaning on these distracting behaviors and substances was my perfectionism, funny enough. Because for whatever reason, I believe that I can be perfect, even though logically I know that I can't. And I believe that I should strive for perfection. Might have to do with my religious upbringing. So anytime that I knew that I wasn't being perfect, it was so painful that I couldn't really accept it. And instead, I could drown it in social media, in drinking, in weed. And so as the days came on, there came a point that I had to face that perfectionism. I didn't even really know what it was, but I was that thing that I was hiding. I couldn't hide from it anymore. There was nothing I could do to distract myself. And I realized that while it was painful to experience that, it was not nearly as painful as I thought it was when I was avoiding it. And it freed me in a way to not have to hide from anything anymore. So I think that's pretty valuable too. If you feel like you're hiding from something, just deleting all of your distractions and addictions will force you to face it and you will become free from it.
Yeah. And that facing our fears is not always as terrible as we think it might be.
Yes. At least in my experience, it was not.
Is there any last words you want to leave us with?
Let me grab a quote. Something that I use a lot in my book is other people's perspectives. My perspective is only a compilation of the brilliant people that I've had the opportunity to learn from. So I'll say this. This is by Roger Ebert. He said, "I believe that if, at the end of it all, according to our abilities, we have done something to make others a little happier and something to make ourselves a little happier, that is about the best we can do. To make others less happy is a crime. To make ourselves unhappy is where all crime starts. We must try to contribute joy to the world. That is true no matter what our problems, our health, our circumstances. We must try." Roger Ebert.
Balance is an elusive goal that looks different for everyone. But finding time for reflection so that we understand what matters is a real challenge. How many of you out there feel like Brandon? And would this 100-day reset work for you?
Now, dear listener, it's your turn. Have you got something to add to the conversation? Then get in touch via the links in the show notes. Whether you have questions, a message of support, or resources that you think might help, we'd love to hear from you. And if by chance you know someone with a story that will inspire others, be sure to let us know. Your contributions help turn inspiration into action, drive positive change, and make life just that little bit better. And if this conversation inspired you to expand your worldview, head to hellohuman.global to join the conversation.